Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
So what people don't understand about elite financial crime is that we have 1 million folks in the U.S. in law enforcement. Of those, 2,000 in the FBI white-collar section investigate sophisticated financial crime. We have over 1,000 industries in the United States. That means we have fewer than 2 FBI agents per industry, and not corporations. That means 3 things. 1, obviously it's not going to work. There aren't remotely enough people. 2, they can't possibly have expertise in the industry. And 3, they don't walk a beat. They wait in their office until there's a criminal referral. And newsflash, corporations don't make criminal referrals against their CEOs. And these massive frauds come from the C-suites, or as the saying in many countries is, fish rot from the head.
That's Ellen's well-known guest this week on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, Professor Bill Black, who has the rarest of distinctions as being one federal regulator and investigator of financial fraud who actually got convictions of 1,000 bank officers and sent hundreds of them to prison. And yes, this was in America. Hello, and welcome once again to another look at our world of money. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host, and today Ellen will delve into that with this preeminent voice of reason and experience. If you're someone who thinks that there's too much regulation in government, you might find your view shifting a bit after listening to what the dynamics are behind the seemingly endless list of crimes and frauds that we've sustained. And we also have another special guest who will round out the picture of how corporations and their allied agencies, such as the Chamber of Commerce, the pro-business legislative group ALEC, and the fleets of lobbyists in D.C. and around the country, have set the stage for privatization of public assets and services like water, electricity, jails, parking authorities, and so forth, and how that shift has managed to set up many cities around the country for decades of financial disadvantage and or permanent loss. Our guest is the founder of the Washington-based think tank In the Public Interest, Donald Cohen. When you understand the origins of the privatization push, you'll see why the idea is so strongly supported by these private interests and how it's become a commonly misunderstood tenet that private is better than public. But now let's check in with Ellen.
So Ellen, you have caused a stir across the country this week with another one of your articles. You come up with these crazy and wonderful ideas like writing off the national debt with $1 trillion coins, and now this week, how to solve profoundly troubling debt issues for states like Illinois, New Jersey, and most of the rest of them who have multi-billion-dollar debts. Your article is called Saving Illinois, Getting More Bang for the State's Bucks, and it was in all kinds of publications. I'm wondering if anybody has nominated you for governor of Illinois yet.
Well, thanks, but no, I tend to get more flack than, well, I got some kudos and some flack. So there were two proposals. I was just drawing on other people's proposals, but there was a proposal in the New York Times a while back when we had a debt ceiling before that the Fed could get more bang for its buck instead of doing quantitative easing for mortgage or for banks by buying toxic mortgages off the books of the banks, that we would go farther toward the, one of the Fed's two mandates is full employment. And clearly, the quantitative easing they did do didn't work for that. I mean, if you look at real employment statistics, including all the people who quit looking for work or are underemployed, there's something like 10% of unemployment still.
Let me interrupt that here for a moment because, you know, when you would think that with the unemployment rate being scored at like 4.3%, one of the lowest unemployment rates in our history, I suppose, you would think that the Fed would have succeeded in its so-called monetary policy. And yet the reality is, as you're indicating, is that the amount of unemployment is in probably double digits. So the disconnect between the notion that the Fed has any impact on the real economy by their policy seems to be self-evident.
Well, it's self-evident to us, but then the problem is they have their figures and we have ours. That's the way. I mean, it's things like 9/11, or there are many things that people generally think they know, but if it's not acknowledged in the mainstream media, then its truth is established by the mainstream media for official purposes. So what the New York Times had proposed was that for its next round of quantitative easing, the Federal Reserve should make low-interest loans to state and local governments, which seems only right and fair. In fact, that was that was a proposal made 100 years ago by Jacob Coxey, who led the first ever march on Washington in 1894, which prompted The Wizard of Oz and my book, Web of Debt. So if the Fed were to make very cheap loans to state and local governments, that would solve their budgeting problems and bail them out and stuff. So that was one proposal. And then the other proposal was made by Scott Baker, who is one of our economic advisors on the Public Banking Institute, and he's also an editor for Op-Ed News, among other things. So he has pored heavily over these CAFRs, the Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports of different state and local governments, and they all have great pools of money. I mean, they're broke if you're looking at the taxes coming in, which can't meet the money going out. But if you look at their savings, they actually have a lot of money, and now all that money's earmarked for different things, and supposedly there are rainy day funds and slush funds. But the problem is with the Illinois has $95 billion in their pension fund. Currently, the payout to the pensioners is only $1.8 billion of that. So less than 2% of their pension fund is actually going to the pensioners. So they're making a 1.5% return. They're aiming for 7.5%. Why do they need 7.5%? Because they've got to cover all these Wall Street costs. It's not for the pensioners. They only need 2% for the pensioners. So two-thirds of that, at least, is going to for their cost of investment. So if you got rid of those middlemen, who are actually not doing a great job, who are sucking up all the profits, well, he proposed paying off the state deficit, which is another $10 billion. So then you'd have $85 billion left. First of all, you'd have to liquidate the pension fund. To pay off $10 billion of it, you've got $85 billion left. Put $8 billion into your own state bank as capital and put the rest in as deposits. And then you can leverage your capital at 10 to 1, but let's say you did it at 8 to 1, so you can create 8 times that many loans backed by the deposits. And he was suggesting that the model be the Bank of North Dakota model. The Bank of North Dakota is making, on average, 3.7% net on their loans. So let's assume that Illinois Bank could also make 3.7%. See, by my figures, they would make $2.37 billion, and they only need $1.8 billion to pay the pensioners. So they would make enough to cover the pensions with some despair. That's $2 billion net after deducting the contributions that come in from the payments going out. So it's actually $11.5 billion going out and $9.8 billion coming in. That means they only have to make up $2 billion, the difference. So that's all you have to make up with your investments, and a state bank could do that easily. So they'd have $570 million to spare, and you could use that for whatever random costs and little things that haven't been figured in there. So let's assume you did that every year. Every year, the pension fund would be self-funding. I mean, the only reason they say these pension funds are unfunded or underfunded, it's because they're not making the percentage that they calculate they would have to make to pay all the bills. But if you only calculate what they have to make to pay the pensioners, which is what they're there for, you can easily do that by turning your fund into a publicly owned bank and following the lead of North Dakota. Meanwhile, you would have your own bank, which could make loans as needed for the state instead of right now. We know that all banks create money. They create money on their books. So they have the power of, they control the money supply, and they control who gets it and on what terms. So if you if the state had its own bank, it could direct that money where the state really needs it and not just where it's going to make a lot of money for the Wall Street banks. This would stimulate the economy even more, plus paying off that $10 billion would give them a better credit rating, so their borrowing costs would go down. So it's a win-win-win, and it would be sustainable. Now, the flack I got on it was, they can't even make their 7.5%, so you're going to make them more underfunded every year. But no, you're not. The reason they have to make 7.5% is because they have all these Wall Street costs that we're going to cut out by having our own bank.
Is it really that much, two-thirds of the costs going for fee management?
Well, all they're paying the pensioners is $1.8 billion. They're aiming for 7.5% in order to be sustainable. So that would be $7.5 billion, right, on a $100 billion pension fund.
You know, in New Jersey, the pension fund has been paying hundreds of millions of dollars. This last year, I think $625 million. The year before, about $725 million in fees and bonuses for Wall Street investment of the fund. But they say that, well, you know, they're managing tens of billions of dollars. This is only 1.5% or 2% of the total. That seems to be fair, which, of course, would look fair in their eyes because it's a pile of change for moving a bunch of paper.
And that is 2%. I mean, if you're only paying out 2% to your pensioners, you've just doubled your costs just by having these Wall Street guys that you have to support. If you got rid of if you have a way to make your 2% to pay the pensioners and cut out the Wall Street people, obviously you're going to cut your costs in half.
So when they say unfunded liabilities, everybody thinks that, well, we're going to have to raise all of these billions of dollars to fill up that pension fund portfolio to full. So, and you're suggesting that we just liquidate it, redeploy it as a public bank so that we can have a sustainable amount of revenue, as well as the resources to pay off the backwater. Where is that money sitting now that that is missing in these accounts? That they've been spent on other state obligations, but where's the money that is in the pension funds sitting now that
well,
could be liquidated?
Well, it's in various investments that are only returning 1.5% on average. I'm not sure what the Illinois fund is paying, but nationally it's 1.5% is the average, so that's not much.
Well, Scott Baker points out in his logic of this that it's a little like saying to say that your pension fund is tens of billions of dollars unfunded and that you have to come up with that money and make it a priority now is a little like trying to accelerate your obligation to pay your house mortgage. So that even though you have maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars that you owe on the house, you don't have to deliver on that today.
And that's the point. The way they figure that we're so far in debt is that we're going to go further and further in debt every year because we can't meet our obligations. But what if you were able to meet it every year in a very efficient way so that the costs were actually half what they are today? Then you're sustainable.
And so what are the constraints or other provisions that would prevent a state from doing this?
Well, I'm sure there's a provision that says the pension funds have to be invested in certain things, whatever. But there's also a provision that says they can't use the pension fund. They've got to pay the pensioners, and they're talking about changing that. I mean, it's all just legislation. They can change it. That's what legislators do. They change legislation. If they're desperate enough, they'll do it. I mean, my favorite example is Roosevelt in 1933. I mean, who would have ever thought you could say, well, we're just not going to use gold anymore, and then now the dollar is fine. We'll just print paper money. I mean, it was outrageous at the time, but everybody agreed because we were so desperate.
Well, in Scott Baker's workup, he said the first thing that they would do would be to create a constitutional amendment or a change to the state constitution that would obligate the state to pay the required pension obligation every year, regardless. So, and in exchange for that constitutional protection, the pension fund would go away and would be redeployed in this other mechanism that you're talking about, the public bank, that would enable all of these other opportunities. And so, as you say, it's a legislative process that that could be done, and that, you know, well, can we just presume that it's not going to happen because...
Well, that's, yes, probably. But that's the thing. I just keep writing and writing about these things because our whole system is messed up. And when, but people don't realize it. I mean, they know there's something wrong, but they don't, can't really put their finger on why it's so expensive and why we're always in debt. So it seems to me the more we sort of peel back the layers of the onion and have a good look, one day people actually will change the system. It's that whole thing about at first they ignore you, then they fight you, then they say, that's what I said all along.
Right. Yeah. Well, it does seem that we're coming to some end point. I know you and I have been saying this for the last couple of years on this program. The game's up. Game's about to be over. They're running out of territory. The runway is just, we're just about at the end of the runway in terms of how much growth can be sustained, how much profitability can be squeezed out of the economic games and framings that we've got, so that these alternatives have got to be seriously thought about in a whole new way, which I suppose doesn't make a bad segue into talking about where we were a week or so ago, a couple weeks ago, when we were meeting with Washington state legislators who were looking at creating a state bank there. My impression was that they were saying, look, this is unsustainable. We have nowhere to go. We can't borrow any more money. We've got massive debt. We need a new solution, and a public bank is it.
Yeah, what impressed me was that it was a workshop that lasted all day. There were three of us went up. They invited us up to help them figure out how to pull this bank off. But there were six senators, four people from the treasurer's office, one person from the controller's office, two local bankers, and a whole room full of people. And nobody was, there was no pushback. You know, there was nobody arguing and saying, oh, no, you can't do that. It was all people, I mean, they were all sincerely trying to figure out how to make this thing go. And Bob Hasegawa, the senator who sponsored it, said, of course, he brought the original bill, it was in 2012, I think, for a state investment bank that got defeated. So he, too, has been sowing these seeds for a long time. But he said, you know, it did his heart good to see his baby coming to fruition. And I feel that way, too. I mean, I went up there and spoke in 2012, I think, along with him at the University of Washington. So it is really cool to see so much interest generated among people who are in a position to actually do it.
As you say, Ellen, it was exciting to see it stand up on its own and start to walk a little bit in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Look forward to hearing your conversation with Bill Black. So anything else for you today, Ellen?
No, that would be all. Great talking to you.
Okay, great talking to you, too.
It's my honor and pleasure to be speaking with Bill Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Bill is a white-collar criminologist, former financial regulator, and author of a book with one of the best titles ever, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He was executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007 and was a central figure in exposing congressional corruption during the savings and loan crisis. It's so great to be talking with you, Bill.
It's great to be back with you.
So the too-big-to-fail banks have been caught in one scandal after another for which no executives have been sent to jail of late, unlike during the savings and loan crisis when you were on the job, when 1,000 bankers were convicted and hundreds went to jail. The latest scandal is at Wells Fargo, which was caught creating 2 million accounts in their cross-selling campaign that were unauthorized by the customers. So can you tell us what that's all about? What is cross-selling, and how did they get away with it?
Cross-selling is when you come in for one product and they say, actually, you should have these six products from us, four or five of which are actually bad for you and will make you poorer, maybe desperately poorer. And it's immensely profitable. Wells Fargo does it worse than anybody in the world, at least certainly in the United States. In fact, twice as often it does the cross-selling compared to any other major bank. That makes it very profitable because they are predators against their customers. Why do they get away with it? They get away with it because we've had the death of financial regulation, and we have the idea that unless it rises to the level of fraud, we really shouldn't do anything about it because the consumer is just making a choice, a bad one, and that's tough. And even if it's a fraud, well, so they committed by their admission, which again is a subset of the problem, 2 million frauds, pay $185 million. Right, so that's under $100 per felony. How many people that you know would trade off paying a $100 fine so that they would get out of a felony conviction?
Right. Actually, I was thinking of something a little more basic. Like, how did 2 million people not notice that they were getting charged for an account they didn't open, or do people just routinely not look at their statements? Or?
First, people routinely don't look at their statements. And second, in a number of cases, and we don't know how often which of these two categories occurred, the employees created fake notification addresses so that the email information would actually come to them instead of to you.
Devious. I saw that Morgan Stanley has just been sued by Massachusetts for the same thing.
Yes, in connection with Smith Barney, so that this is a retail brokerage. But again, the same cross-selling pressures. And what people need to know is that this was not the type of thing where the small folks in the food chain, the low-level employees, got large bonuses. They got trivial amounts of bonuses. It was really extortion, that if you didn't meet these sales quotas through cross-selling, you would be fired. You'd be fired for cause, and so you'd not only be unemployed, but it'd be very difficult to get another job in banking. Now, the people at the top of the food chain, of course, they got literally hundreds of millions of dollars in additional compensation. Again, not simply because of the 2 million frauds, but the tens of millions of products that should have never been sold that were sold because they had motivated some over 200,000 employees to act like banshees trying to sell you product that was bad for you.
And why is it that during the savings and loan crisis you were able to prosecute so many people and now none of that happens? How did the regulators get captured?
So what people don't understand about elite financial crime, or indeed elite white-collar crime in general, is that we have 1 million folks in the U.S. in law enforcement. Of those, 2,000 in the FBI white-collar section investigate sophisticated financial crimes. Regular police do not. We have over 1,000 industries in the United States. That means we have fewer than 2 FBI agents per industry, and not corporations. That means 3 things. One, obviously it's not going to work. There aren't remotely enough people. 2, they can't possibly have expertise in the industry. And 3, they don't walk a beat. They wait in their office until there's a criminal referral. And newsflash, corporations don't make criminal referrals against their CEOs. And these massive frauds that caused the crisis and are related to it and even subsequent to it come from the C-suites, or as the saying in many countries is, fish rot from the head. So the only way you're going to get criminal referrals is episodically from whistleblowers. and systematically from regulators. In the savings and loan debacle, our small agency, the Office of Thrift Supervision, made over 30,000 criminal referrals. Right. And that just begins the process of this knowledge transfer from the regulators who have the expertise about the fraud schemes to the FBI and to the prosecutors. And I train the FBI agents and the assistant U.S. attorneys, and I help train our own folks internally in these fraud techniques. But mostly it's because it was the second highest priority of the head of our agency. Ed Gray's top priority was getting the crooks out of running the savings and loans because, of course, as long as they're in charge, they cause massive additional losses. But once we had done that, our highest priority was to get them convicted. So flash forward, what's different now? Well, there are no leaders like Ed Gray, haven't been for a full 20 years. And anyone like him is excluded from the top leadership of the regulatory ranks. And as a result, the criminal referral process was eliminated under the Bush administration, but had been in substantial decline before then. And for reasons that pass all understanding, the Obama administration hasn't recreated it, or if it's done so, it's done so secretly. And there's no evidence that they've created, and they've never talked about it. So they were in the current crisis, which in dollar losses is 160 times larger than the savings and loan debacle. There were zero criminal referrals by the Office of Thrift Supervision, zero criminal referrals by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is supposed to regulate Wells, by the way, zero referrals, criminal referrals by the Fed, and the FDIC is smart enough to refuse to answer the question.
I guess so. It was the city of LA that actually pursued it, and now the state of California, the treasurer, has said they're not going to do business with Wells anymore. So arguably it's the state and local governments that are more on the job, maybe because they're the ones getting taken advantage of.
And that was true during the run-up to the crisis as well, but you're correct. And again, the folks that came first are the whistleblowers, the employees, and also some customers. Indeed, the LA County DA, who, as you said, brought the action a year before the feds did in 2015, said that in response to his action, over a thousand customers and employees came forward. And this has been the case in this crisis because of the death of criminal referrals by the regulators. The immensely useful thing has been all these whistleblowers who have brought these criminal cases on a platinum platter to the regulators and the prosecutors. But in every case, they've been spurned. And even when the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, the National Commission to Investigate the Causes of the Crisis, made criminal referrals, the Department of Justice failed to act on a single one of them. And it's not like they're losing their cases. They simply refuse to bring any of these cases under the idea that, well, it's not really a crime if somebody in a nice suit does it. And the contradictory, well, maybe it is a crime, but we don't want to rock the boat and cause another financial crisis. So as I always tell folks, modern-day financial regulators are far more sophisticated than we were 25 years ago because we had never figured out that leaving fraudulent officers in charge of our largest financial institutions was the way to achieve financial stability.
Right. Speaking of which, the other hot item in the news, or another, is Deutsche Bank, which is teetering on the edge of collapse because the U.S. Department of Justice demanding $14 billion to settle an investigation into its selling of mortgage-backed securities. So some people say that was in retaliation for 13 billion euros that the European Commission wants Apple to pay to Ireland for back taxes. I don't know about that. But anyway, Deutsche Bank has been involved in all these sovereign debt. They're the counterparties on a lot of derivatives on sovereign debt on various countries. So arguably they can't allow Deutsche Bank to go down because it'll take down all those other banks and all those countries, arguably. But they can't bail it out because Angela Merkel said that the Italians couldn't bail their banks out. So what do you think? Are we facing the next giant collapse, like some people say?
No, and it's because, like pigs, some banks are more equal than others, and they can say all they want, they can point out the hypocrisy all they want, but they're not going to let Deutsche Bank fail because that would, in fact, trigger a new global financial crisis. But you are certainly correct that it would be terrible politically for Merkel and her party. And so they're dreading it. But first, the final settlement will not be $14 billion, and it won't even be close to $14 billion. This is just the initial number in the negotiations. And what people should be upset about is not that the number is large, but that the number is all the other settlements, is so small compared to the losses that these folks caused. Mm-hmm. The estimate is, by economists, is that over the course of the recession and full recovery, we will lose $24.3 trillion. A trillion is 1,000 billion in GDP. 9.3 million Americans lost their jobs. 5 million American jobs that would have normally been created were not created. Hispanic households with at least a college degree lost 70% of their wealth. Similar figure for blacks, households with college degrees or beyond, is above 50%. This was a financial calamity, and politically no one's going to let that happen again soon. And that includes Deutsche Bank. Now, Deutsche Bank is dirty, and Deutsche Bank has been dirty in innumerable things. And of late, and indeed there's a major story running on this today, they're also dirty in terms of helping huge scale breaches of the limitations on doing business with Russia that were imposed as sanctions for the Ukrainian actions.
Maybe that's another reason they keep these banks alive. They need them for their dirty work. And one more question. I know you're kind of short on time, but so what would you see as a solution to all this control, fraud, and regulatory capture? I know you've mentioned that a public option in banking would be a good idea. Of course, I'm totally all for that, but I just wonder what your thinking is on that. What would that look like, and how would it be implemented?
Well, and both Wells and Deutsche Bank are good examples of this because both of them had as major functions, indeed, Wells had as its fundamental defining strategy predating on its customers. Deutsche Bank did as well, although, as you say, Deutsche Bank did so many things. So there should be a public option, and there have been many countries that have had postal banks, for example, that have provided customers with good old plain vanilla savings product at good prices and with high convenience. I always warn that there's nothing magic about public ownership that prevents banks from being misused by politicians if they control the banks. There have been many scandals involving public banks as well as private banks. But all of them, for example, Fannie and Freddie, the conventional wisdom that's been created by people spinning it is this is all about the government. In fact, it's all about perverse private incentives. Fannie and Freddie were privatized. The ownership was private. The management was private, and it had pure private sector type incentive systems shaped by management to facilitate fraud. So you want to fix things, you start with compensation. You don't pay enormous amounts of money based on purported performance without evaluating it in very conservatively for quality of the loan product, and you ban cross-selling because it's inherently abusive and predatory, and there are academic studies on this. You give folks, you know, perhaps $300,000 a year as a salary. They can send their kids to the best schools and such. But the really big bucks, if they want to get those, prove over 20 years that performance really was stellar and was really due to your skills. And then I don't care if they give you big bucks if you really produce stellar work. But otherwise, executive compensation is the thing that cries out to be fixed. And again, it needs to be fixed. It's worse in the private sector, but they're too often, when they create public banks, they create very similar perverse incentives through the compensation systems. Don't do that when you create those banks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good advice. And then I've heard you talk about breaking up the big banks too.
Absolutely. There shouldn't ever permit a bank to be too big to fail, too big to jail, and this is necessary both economically in terms of avoiding systemic risk. It's necessary for efficiency. The smaller banks operate better, but most of all, from my perspective, it's essential to restoring democracy and ending our current version of crony capitalism.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what you would do with the derivatives. What would happen if they were just all netted out? Is that, you know, some people say you could declare them all illegal and we'd be the better off for it, but I don't know if that can be done.
Derivatives are a complicated subject. There are some that are literally many hundreds of years old and work quite well in connection with farming, and there are others that are disastrous, so you got to get rid of. They should have simply repealed the bill that was passed to crush Brooks Lieborn's effort to protect us from derivatives, and then you should go case by case, and there you shouldn't be able to put out new product with a dramatically greater risk without experimenting with it for years first and showing that it can be done safely.
I've been speaking with Bill Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One.
As the troubles associated with leaving our public money in the hands of private profiteers mount, with increasingly obvious examples of self-dealing at the public's expense, a reformist movement has emerged in recent years to reclaim the rights of the public to control their own assets and services, many of which have come under assault from the cultural meme that suggests that government can do nothing right or well, and that private management is always more efficient and effective. It's called privatization. This notion has been intentionally circulated for decades, and the result has been the transferal of public assets and services to private parties, like the prison system, a wide variety of public operations like parking authorities, water departments, schools, even fire departments, and many others that have gone private at greater expense to the public and often with less positive outcomes. Now, a new report by the nonprofit think tank In the Public Interest focuses on not only how these transfers of responsibility have undermined the commonwealth, but how they have systemically deepened economic inequality by diminishing worker income and protections and a host of other aspects. We spoke with Donald Cohen, the founder and executive director of In the Public Interest, about that report and how this trend got a foothold in America and what it means.
It got its start in, I'd say, a couple of different ways. But the first way is you and your listeners have, you know, read about the Powell memo and some of the, you know, which was just one thing that happened in the 1970s when major corporations realized that they were losing significant policy battles.
And let me ask you about the Powell memo, by the way, because that's a very interesting bit of American history that is such a driver. Would you describe what that was?
Well, it was, it was Lewis Powell, who at the time worked for the Chamber of Commerce, was an attorney for the Chamber of Commerce. He became a Supreme Court justice, was commissioned by the Chamber to write a memo, a sort of a what-is-to-be-done memo, given there was a belief that capitalism was on the ropes because of folks like Ralph Nader and auto safety and Rachel Carson and pesticides, and this is in the 1971, I believe. So he wrote this memo that ultimately got leaked that said, okay, we've got to push back in a number of ways. So it's gotten a lot of press, and people should read it. It's findable. But it wasn't the only thing. There were other business organizations who were saying, we need to do things differently in this period of time. We're losing the battle. And so, but Powell memo is a bit of a lightning rod because it's one of the few kind of documents that came out that's just so clear that they needed to build an infrastructure to try to get back in control, political control in the country, they being corporate America along with conservatives and others. So in terms of your question of how privatization started, at the beginning of what I call the assault on government, say 1970s, 70s into 80 into the 1980s when Reagan was president, there were influential political conservative strategists who argued that privatization, in fact, needed to be a key pillar in the attack on government for a couple of reasons, one of which is, and the most important being, is that it would reshape political alliances, that it would, in their words, break the pro-budget, pro-government political consensus, political constituencies. And so a number of things happened after that. Those were articles and policy papers written by strategists Stuart Butler, Madsen Peary. These are some of the big names of right-wing thinking back in those days. So that's one piece. They decided that it would be a key way to get control by disengaging people's connection to government services with the government, and therefore reducing demands for increasing budgets, separating, for increasing public budgets, isolating in weak constituencies that didn't have the power to add for as much, in political lobbying and advocacy. That's one piece. They decided it was a good way to do it. Second thing is, this again is part of a strategic push, articulated by many of the same people, is that government contracting had been happening forever at municipal level, at the county level, at school boards, everywhere. And so that actually is not new. It's ramped up, but it's not new. But what the conservatives were able to accomplish is to turn, at that time, what was actually standard operating procedure to have contracts of different kinds into an ideological crusade. They made it about government, is bad and private sector is good. So now you get people who get, conservatives or Republicans or whoever get elected to city councils. Their job, one of their things they got to check off on their agenda is to privatize things.
Yeah, let me ask you about Ronald Reagan. He was a great message bearer. Was that part of his?
Oh, absolutely. What's interesting about Reagan is he's a huge advocate of privatization. He did embrace that privatization would be a political and governing strategy, but he didn't get many things done. He did some, but, he lost a lot of those battles. But by the time Clinton came in, there was a little bit of a ramp up. This is part of a comprehensive strategy to delegitimize government. Government can do no right. Reagan's famous quote, the most dangerous words in the American vocabulary, I'm here from the government, I'm here to help. So ideologically and philosophically, message-wise, absolutely, he made huge progress there. And in the same period, the exalting of private enterprise and private sector can do anything better. And so that's going on in the background and is key enabler that when people get elected to government bodies, they've got the idea environment on their side, and they've got the money and the strategy on their side.
So privatization is, now just to be, as you would define it, I think people generally know, but it's basically moving the assets and the operations of what were once publicly owned entities into the hands of private parties for the sake of their profiting, but also for the sake of providing some sort of a financial return to the sellers, to the cities, counties, and states. How has that worked out?
Oh, it's not worked out very well at all. I mean, first off, it's useful to separate services from assets. So assets, they sell off the parking meters in Chicago for 75 years. That's one thing. So that's a sale, and the city got a little over $1 billion in exchange for the city's parking meters revenue for and control for 75 years. The city's got some cash. They got totally taken in terms of how much cash they should have gotten if they were securitizing that future revenue. And they also spent it way quicker than they said they would because they had need. So that was a bad deal. In terms of services, it isn't more like the government doesn't get money. They get to say, we are saving money, whether it be a trash system or a janitorial service or what have you. They say, private companies say, we will save money, give it to us. And the reality of that is suspect for a number of reasons, one of which is when they do save money, it's because they reduce wages and working conditions. There's several ways they save money. It's actually not rocket science. They want to be more efficient, and so and save money. We say, what does more efficient mean? Because you got to still deliver the service. So efficiency means you pay less for things, and you get more return profit. So when they outsource in services, what they pay less on are real simple: labor costs, which are probably the primary expenditure. So less. Lower wages, fewer benefits, less secure pension, retirement funds. So that's one big chunk. And the other chunk is they cut corners because, in fact, they want to spend less money. So cutting corners means, this is a case that happened last year, I believe, Aramark, huge food contractor in the prisons in Ohio and Michigan, started serving food with maggots in it because they spent less money on their food and their quality control. That's efficiency. They're spending less, and they're getting more outcome, profit.
Wow.
And so that's what that's kind of the story in a nutshell.
So when a private company takes over a service or an asset, let's say that part of your report indicates that there's new user fees often show up,
mm-hmm.
and I think also an increase in existing user fees, there's a logic to why that might happen, I suppose, certainly, because a private company has to pay for the asset or the service channel that it bought, and then its bottom line is profiteering. So almost by definition, it's going to cost more. Is that about
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, here's the thing. Here's the basic truth. As is gravity. That fundamental. things cost money, right? And so the user fees going up, for example, as you say, there's a logic to it because things cost money. Now, the question is, what things? The provision of the service costs money, and so before I get to profit and other things, if in fact we're not generating enough tax revenue or other kinds of revenue to pay for those services, and we let them deteriorate, then a private company comes in and says, well, the only way we can make it work and retool it and make it modern is to raise fees. And in some cases, they may be right. We may need to spend more money on things like water fees and things like that, water services. You can do it in a progressive way, but we may be spending too little on something. But then you add what else they spend money on, the money that I say it would describe as diverted from the system. It's profit, it's lobbying expenses, campaign contributions, it's debt service. It's sort of the cost of doing business that are
right.
completely extra. And so that money is being taken out of the service. So it's kind of a double whammy. So you're getting higher fees too often on people who can't afford them for some needs that we may need extra cash for, but for a lot of needs we don't.
And how does this then perpetuate the inequality in our economy?
In a couple of ways. So there's an increase in user fees for people coming out of the criminal kind of prison. They may still be on probation. They have to wear an ankle bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
They have to pay for their ankle bracelet. It's a little hard for people coming out of prison to get a job and have other needs and housing and all this, and just a general basic good life. And so now they are not only coming out of prison and, burdened by that, reintegrating, but they're burdened by a cost about their ankle bracelet. They got to pay for it. We put them in debt, and the private company, and the biggest is VI Incorporated, owned by Geo Group, they're making money. So some are getting wealthier, and some are getting poorer. I mean, it happens at that level of detail, step by step. And the other larger point on fees, too. We're not against all fees in all cases, and that would be too general thing to say. But essentially, when you take something and make it an individual, you know, something that the individual pays for rather than the society pays for, that's privatization. That's making the private individual responsible for public services. We all do have to be responsible for public services. That's why I say we're not blanketly opposed to fees in general. But we have other needs. You know, our public goals have other needs. We need people who are poor to be able to get access to jobs. They need to get transportation. They have to pay $10 to cross the bridge in New York or more, 15. That hurts them. So we have to be able to make decisions about what we want to publicly fund. And to the extent that we are privately funding particular services that only we use but everyone benefits from, that's making us consumers as opposed to citizens, where we get to say we put our money in a pot, we pay for things because we have multiple goals. It's not just about just people consuming public services.
And that tends to then, the impact of those extra fees or extra costs, the more expensive life just to maintain, puts pressure on the existing segregations and inequities in our system, right?
Exactly. It's about economic segregation. It'll obviously be about race and gender because there's all sorts of overlays there. The more we ask to act as individuals, we're all individuals, and we have to be responsible citizens and all that, but the more we have to act and meet our needs only as by individuals, you know, as individuals, the less we have common purpose. You know, in fact, you think about it this way. If the only people who paid for schools were people with parents with kids in school at the time, we would have less money, and we would also not be realizing that everyone benefits by children, whether you have them or not. We all benefit if children are educated, if all children are educated. So there's a social benefit, there's a moral benefit, and there's even an economic benefit by all of us, by every kid being educated, regardless of whether you have a child in school.
Well, it seems like there's a growing awareness around the effects and the negative outcomes of privatization around the country. Are you seeing a trend in that in any way? How can we turn the corner on this decades-old downward cycle of privatization of common interests?
Well, we're starting, whether I'd call it turning the corner, we're starting to see real positive signs. There are people winning, you know, stopping outsourcing proposals all the time in the country. There's people proposing them all the time, but there's lots of people winning. I mean, the most prominent issue right now in terms of this is private prisons, and the Department of Justice already made it, taken the first fantastic step. Hillary Clinton is also committed to going further with private immigration centers and other private prisons that's operated by the federal government. And so we're seeing a lot of progress there, and we're seeing generally more press, more awareness of a fundamental question. Who runs America, who provides the service for America, and who benefits?
Right. So what are some of the things that we can do policy-wise to make changes on this?
There's a number of things, one of which is, again, like I said earlier, we don't want to end all contracting. There may be things that need to be contracted for. But we believe a couple of things, one of which is every service that is provided as for the public, whether it's contracted or provided internally, is our service. We want control over it. We want to determine the wage, how the working conditions and the wages. We want to determine the quality. We want to be able to determine everything about it, and we ought to be able to watch and every day and make sure that we're getting what we pay for. And that's at the conceptual level. But you take that to a policy level, and first thing is transparency. We need to be able to know everything about contracts, the same level of detail about contracts and contractors that we know about government agencies and when government agencies provide the service, which is pretty much everything. When things go private, we lose a lot of access to information. They say that they're trade secrets, proprietary information. We don't have to tell you, but it's not true. Second is set standards for wages for employment. We set wages for quality. We set standards. We set standards for sort of the full set of things that people who, all of us, expect high-quality government services demand. So, and then the third big piece is then you have to make sure that that's happening. So this is about contracting, and I'll get to one more piece after this about how this affects privatization. What often happens in governments of all sides, federal government, everywhere, it's not often, it's always. If you contract something out, it's sort of axiomatic. You you hire somebody to paint your house. If you don't watch, bad things happen. It may be corruption, crookedness, incompetence, just lack of foresight, no malice. It could be any of those things. But without watching and managing, bad things happen. And every government outsources things, sells things off, but never adds the staffing to watch.
Uh-huh.
It's huge. It's huge. There are conservative people, very conservative people. A guy who used to work under George W. Bush, who is now saying we need to hire a million more federal bureaucrats just to manage the contracting that's been done.
Uh-huh.
And he's not, this isn't ideological. This is just, do you want to manage your services well?
Right.
So if you do all of that, then you will also realize that many things are, from a managerial perspective, from a cost perspective, from a quality perspective, it's simply better to do it directly. We have more managerial control. We will save taxpayer money. We will take all that money that's being taken for profit and the CEO salaries. We get to put that back into urgently needed services. And so that's the full package. When you got a contract, do it really right, because that's going to close the door to all the low road stuff that should never happen in the first place.
Interesting. What's your sense of the messaging that's going to be required, or how do we promulgate that idea in this conversation?
Yeah. It's about public control. We've done a good amount of research on this. People don't know who people work for, whether the man or woman who's picking up the trash works for the city, or they work for waste management, and people don't know where people get their paychecks, but they know when something's a public service. And they may not even care who they get their paycheck from. But they sure as hell know that it's a public service and they want it good, and they want to make sure it's controlled. And so we speak about public control, whether it's contracted, whether it's in, whether it's out. That's the essential piece, is that in a democracy, we think that we ought to have democratic public control over public goods and services. And to the work that you do on public banking, we think access to debt is a public good. We think access to education is a public good. Clean air is a public good. I mean, you could go down the list. And so we believe in democratic control of all of those things. There's an article that I wrote that was published a few months back in Talking Points Memo on the history of privatization, 50s or 60s, I think. You might find it interesting because it gets to some of the points that you've made. And one of the things we're going to start looking at is the privatization of regulatory enforcement.
Ah.
We're just getting started because it just keeps popping up in food safety and consumer stuff, and so we're going to talk to experts, but we see it, so we're going to look pretty broadly over the next few months and see what we can pull together. Is this a dynamic? Because often these things are one-offs. They feel like one-offs. There's a problem here. There's a problem here. But we like to look for trends.
Your report is really interesting and also rather dramatic, graphing of the amount of costs and the effects of having privatized certain things like water and even the GED testing and a host of other services that we take for granted. The report is called How Privatization Increases Inequality, But in the Public Interest. And we've been talking with Donald Cohen, the executive director and founder. Donald, thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to working with you on this as we move this country around a bit.
Super. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with